Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, I'm Jody Peterman. We know that no one understands what you need better than you do. We take care to guide you through the legal process, ensuring that you're able to make the decisions that are best for you. If you have a personal injury, criminal, or family law issue, please take a look at our website to learn more about our practice. We offer a free initial consultation for personal injury cases. Give us a call at 229-375-5680. We have a reputation for being accessible and treating our clients well. We look forward to hearing from you.
Hello, I'm Guy Terry of Terry and Peterman. At Terry and Peterman, we are committed to representing the hardworking residents of South Georgia in personal injury, criminal, and family law matters. For years, we have worked with college students in this area to ensure legal issues do not disrupt their academic careers. We also represent military families struggling with divorce and family law issues. We rely upon over 30 years of combined experience to provide aggressive representation for our clients.
Welcome to Peach State Pandemonium, a production brought to you by the GWH Radio Network, where we take you down memory lane for a look at professional wrestling the way it used to be, with conversations from those who paved the way. And now, the GWH Radio Network presents Peach State Pandemonium.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to another edition of Peach State Pandemonium. We're here, I believe this is now 3 weeks in a row, so doing pretty well so far. This is Rich Tate, and I'm, of course, as always, joined by Jay West, Jerry Oates, and Bobby Simmons. Guys, how you doing this evening?
Doing good, Rich.
Glad
doing
to be
wonderful
here.
On my end.
Still suffering a little bit from the pollen, but we're getting better. Been to the doctor, and she gave me some magic pills, and feeling a little better.
Magic pill. I love it.
That's not code for Colorado talk.
Yeah, I was going to say he probably flew to Colorado. And
anyway, antibiotics, and at any rate, it's helping. I'm feeling like talking a little better, which may be bad for the fans, but anyway, I'm here.
Well, Felix, I want to ask you, how's Oscar doing?
Well, we got him home last night, and we got him into bed, and he had a good night's sleep. He got up today, and he sat up a good part of the day today because he had nurses and rehab people he was talking to. And his nurse came to see him tonight, and he just went and laid down a few minutes ago. He's pooped. He's been up most of the day, but he's doing okay.
You sound like a little tired, Bobby. Like you might need a nurse yourself.
I know I'm fine. I just had a bad long day at work today, but it's a little unusual for both of us. He's having to learn how to do things for himself, and I'm having to learn how to help him as much as I can, and still not, I want him to do it, and he's doing it, and that's a good thing. Yeah, we're going to be all right.
It's good to have somebody in the house, right?
Yeah. Well, he went to bed. I'm here on the cell. No, it is. It's nice. Hey, yeah, it's good to have somebody to talk to.
Well, anybody got anything they want to throw out there before we get into the topic tonight?
Don't forget the Wrestling 2 thing coming up in May the 3rd.
Yep.
I think that's going to be a good little tribute thing they're doing for him show up there in North Cobb. That's going to be okay. I talked to John about a week and a half ago. He's here. He's doing real well, and sounds good.
I saw a little video they put up on that that he was in. It was really nice to see him doing that.
All right, guys, I guess let's go ahead and jump into it. In the continuing series talking about the Georgia Wrestling Hall of Fame, tonight we're going to be talking about the class of 2010. And first up on the docket is Abdullah the Butcher. Bobby, you were in the ring with this guy many times.
Yeah. He's in the news this week. Abdullah came in when he first came here. Of course, we had never had anything like him in Georgia. Georgia was a wrestling territory, and regardless of what your gimmicks were, whoever you were when you came in here, it was basically a wrestling territory. And I can remember several meetings that was held at the office. I wasn't involved. I was just assisting in the office at the time. I wasn't in the back. But I can remember several meetings that was held about bringing him in. And the consensus finally was that you could make a lot of money with him, provided you could control him. And when I say control him, that means keep his gimmick as real as possible. So they brought him in, and they told him, they said, you know, we don't want you talking. We don't want you going out in public. We want you to – they put him up in a hotel up on Peachtree Street in Atlanta and told him, said, we'll pick you up. We'll take you to towns. We'll bring you back. You know, make sure you got food in the room and stuff, but don't be out walking the streets. And, you know, let's keep it as real as we can. Took him to the bank, set him up a checking account where all he had to do was sign an X to cash the check. I mean, they really tried to do it well, and it worked well for about 2 weeks. And then they caught him at the airport toting the briefcase and handing out pictures, and that kind of killed the gimmick. But Abby was. I never had any problem with him in the ring. He always worked hard. Me and him worked well together. We always had little things that me and him did between the two of us, I don't know what it was like to actually wrestle him. I never had that pleasure, and I'm kind of thankful for that. I did have that elbow dropped on me, and I know that was very snug, not because of the elbow, but because of the body mass that came down beside you and landed on your face. But Eddie was okay. He drew a lot of money here, and I think he drew a lot of money everywhere he ever went. And he homesteaded. He got here. He never left. Still lives here. And he still makes appearances from time to time.
And great barbecue, from what I understand.
Hey, did you read the paper this week?
Actually, no. When you said that, I've been out of town. I just got back.
They shut his restaurant down.
Oh.
evidently last year, He had a health inspection, and he did a 66 on it, and they closed him, and he corrected it. Well, they went and inspected him again, and he flunked again, and they have shut him down until he makes a bunch of corrections. And the way they described some of the things they found, I'm really very glad I've never been over there to eat. But I kept the article. It was in the paper this week. I've got it over here on a table, as a matter of fact. It was rather interesting.
He didn't stick a fork in the inspector or nothing, did he?
I don't know.
Jerry, how much did you get to work with Abby over the years?
Quite a bit. He was as long as you let him, he's going to do his stuff. You know, he was limited, but, I mean, you could have a match with him. I was in Japan with him a lot, and I'm telling you, you're talking about being over? They loved him over there. He was over. I know I walked by his room one day, and he said, "Hey, Jim," he said, "come on in the room here, man." He had old boots, old butcher britches, the white ones where he looked like he worked in a meat market. He had them all clean. The boots were polished all up in the windows around his room. So what are you doing, man? He said, "I'm supposed to have a sale." "A sale?" He said, "Yeah. People in different restaurants and different businesses, he let them know. They come up and bid on it." Ain't no telling what this man took in. I'm telling you, man, it was still in the garage sale in Tokyo at the hotel.
I love it.
And then I was going to breakfast one morning. I was down in the lobby, and here he comes, he had on a derby. Had on a shirt, you know, he always had his stuff autographed, Mr. Butcher. He was all dressed up. I said, "What are you doing, man?" He said, "I'm just getting in." He reached in his pocket and pulled out a wad of money. He said, "I made this last night signing autographs in some club." He knew how to make money, I'm telling you. That joker knew how to make money.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I'm telling you, he was so over there. I mean, it was just unreal. And like Bobby said, if you could control him, and the one that was doing TV somewhere, over there in Japan, and Baba was sitting there helping, you know, do the commentating, and they told him, whatever you do, this nation, you know, when you do TVOS nationwide, he said, don't bother Baba. Don't bother him. His match is rolling along. He bails right out of the ring, had one of those long tables, turned every monitor over. I mean, they have high dollar stuff over there. Dumped all that stuff in the floor, went over the table, jumped on Baba. I mean, but they didn't do nothing to him. But yeah, I enjoyed working with him. Like, you had to let him know about, hey, man, don't be doing any crazy stuff with me because I got something to do. Oh, champ, I wouldn't do that to you. I wouldn't do that to you. I know you're not going to do it to me.
Yeah, he was.
That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, he was.
He's notorious for that.
He was notorious for that, yeah, yeah. I mean, he never did it with me either. But you know, I've seen him do it to guys. And, you know, he always had it was funny. He'd come up with the weirdest stuff, man. He'd have a coat hanger, a metal coat hanger, the hook end of it. Or he'd have a fork. Or
a frog gigger one night.
Do what?
A frog gigger. I'm telling you, man.
Oh, geez.
He had more stuff in those boots than some kind of Wichita lineman with all his tools in some pouch. He had more tools. He'd use them too. I'm telling you, he'd use them. But no, you know, and like Bobby said, I mean, he drew money everywhere he went. You know, I mean, there's no doubt about that. And I don't know how many years he made the Japan run, but he made a lot of money over there for them and himself, you know. And Baba didn't work. I mean, Butcher didn't work for nothing.
No.
Jay, what about you?
He was a big draw wherever he went, and he could bleed with the best of them. I mean, you know, talk about Gordon in the term Crimson Mask. You know, he made Dusty look like he had no spots on his head at all. But if you ever heard the guy's real voice, you would never place it with the way he looked. And there was a radio personality, I'm sure everybody remembers, Ludlow Porch, who had shows for years on Atlanta radio. And in the late 70s, he started talking with Talking Wrestling, and somebody brought up Abdullah's name being Larry Shreve. And so Ludlow, talked about it a bit. And this was before most of the fan magazines had, you know, this information. So it was pretty new news when Ludlow was talking about it. So down at the Atlanta TV, the old 17 studios, I asked Abby about it one day. I said, have you heard this? And he said, ah, it's no big deal. So, you know, he wasn't really concerned at all. But one particular night at the Omni, I remember quite well, fans were going berserk. He was outside the ring. You didn't have to worry about introducing Abby because he would, just as soon as his opponent would hit the apron, he would go after him. That was the end of the introduction. But, whatever was going on, the crowd was building up, and Abby was outside the ring. And he was about 15 feet from where I was sitting there at the, you know, at the table at ringside. And all of a sudden, I saw this thing come flying through the air from the seats, the ringside seats. It was about five or six rows back. And I said, I hope it's a paper cup. And it wasn't. It was a industrial-sized bolt that was as big as my fist. And I'm glad it hit Abdullah and not me, but it hit him right square on the head. He just shook it off and went right back to business, you know. And I never forget that. I said, man, I sure am glad that person had good aim, unless in fact they were aiming at me. But you know, he just took things like that in stride.
So he didn't care.
All right.
Let me say this too about it. Okay. He was genuinely, you know, Jerry was talking about him, you know, making money, but he called him in the room and showed him the stuff. Larry was Butcher. He was generally a nice guy. You know, he sort of, if you could get him where you could talk to him and he wasn't in front of the fans where he had to be the Butcher or the star of the show, he was a nice guy.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, the boots that I refereed in for the last probably 10 years of my career, and I still have them back here. and can still, I mean, they're still as good now as they were. He drew my foot one night. We were in the dressing room. He drew my foot on a piece of paper and took it to Japan with him. And when he came back, he brought me a pair of boots. And they're so soft, the leather's so soft, they won't even stand up. They just flop over when you set them down.
Wow.
They are a wonderful pair of shoes. And like Jerry said, he was making so much money. I asked him when he got back, I said, what owe you? He said, $10. You know, I mean, that may have been what he paid, or he might have got them free. I don't know. But, you know, he was a nice guy, and it still is. I saw him a couple years ago down in Macon. He was on a walker, and he was he looks the same, sounds the same, and seems to be doing okay.
All right, next person to talk about in the class of 2010 would be the late and so very beautiful Ann Gonkel. Bobby, I'll let you start with this one.
Well, I first met Ann about 1970. I was running errands for Harbin at the Atlanta office, and she needed some furniture moved out of her house. And me and Larry Nichols, who was a little older than I was, we rode out to her house, and we moved some stuff around for her. That was the first time I'd ever met her. Little did I know, 2 years later, I'd be working for her. She gave me my break by forming the company that she formed. She wasn't treated well by her husband's business partners, and that's well known and documented. There's a doubt in my mind they had every intention of stealing that business from her, and she'd have walked away with nothing. And she was a business lady. She's a business lady. Very salty. Very, as you say, very gorgeous. Fit in anywhere. You know, it was nothing to see her on the arm of somebody that you. I was at her house one night late, and she came home and had Burt Reynolds with her. So, you know, I mean, she dated whomever she wanted, and she nice lady. I'm not sure she was the smartest businesswoman that was come down the path, but she surrounded herself with people that knew the business, and she did all right. We did good for a couple of years there, but I can't say enough about her. She was just good to me. She treated me very, very well. In 1985, when she tried to run some towns again, and Jerry and Ted were there and several others, she offered me a job running her office, and I tried my best to do what I could for her, but it just time frame wasn't right, or the money wasn't right. I'm not sure what was going on there with her, but my personal opinion was she was looking for somebody to sue, but that's my opinion, and it wasn't a real good time as far as the business was concerned then, but I enjoyed working with her. I'm glad I got to know her, and I can't say nothing but nice things about her, the way she treated me.
Jerry?
Bobby pretty well summed it up. You know, I really felt sorry for her, you know, when Ray passed away. When Ray passed away, he was one of the most powerful men in professional wrestling. I mean, as far as, you know, people, you know, what Ray said went, you know, and people listened to him, and him and Eddie Graham always got along good together, and it was a horrible thing when he passed away, and what those cutthroats did to her. I mean, I can't even imagine. You picture yourself, if that was your wife in that situation, and, you know, they just, you're done. You're out of here. Well, that was her husband's business, and, of course, he had partners, but, I mean, I never understood how they did what they did to her. I mean, I really don't, and I always felt sorry for her, and like Bobby said, she tried to start up again, and I know Ted and myself and her met with Ted Turner. He wanted TV back at the station, and so we had a meeting. That's the first time I'd ever met him, you know. And the meeting was over, he said, let's do it. We're going to do this thing, and we could have got some guys, and we could have, you know, who knows what. But I don't think Ann at that time had enough money to, you know, to do what she needed to do. And I'm sure she was hurt, you know, emotionally and mentally by what had happened to her. And But, you know, she did try, and then she got, you know, ill, of course, and the rest is history. But
I don't think she knew how sick she was, Jerry, when we started that.
Bobby, I think she was sick then.
Yeah, I think she was too. I just don't think she knew how bad it was.
No, and I really felt sorry for her, and I think we all tried, but it was just nothing there really to work with. You know, we did try, and I think we had a good little group, but like Bobby said, I think she was, I don't know if she knew how sick she was, but it was a sad ending. It was a sad ending for her. And if anybody deserves to be there, she does, for what she went through.
Jay, what can you add?
Well, you know, I'd never heard anything about her prior to Ray Gunkel's death. And then, of course, after that, when the All-South split came up with the Atlanta office, she got a lot of media coverage. And, you know, she was out there. And with her looks and what she was trying to do, got a lot of publicity. I never, ever read anything negative about her during the whole time she was trying to do what she was doing with All South, or even later on. She seemed to be a very stand-up person. And I know when All South first started, she was the face of the program, and she seemed a little uncomfortable there at the start, but she grew into it. And she, you know, she tried her best, as Bobby and Jerry had said. And she brought some folks in, and we saw some wrestling here, wrestlers here that, you know, we would have never seen had All South never taken place. And I think a lot of the fans owe her a lot for that. In her later days there, it was probably 84, early 85, Charlie Smith had given her my phone number. And she called me. She wasn't offering me any work. She just wanted some outside opinion, some third-party opinion on some things she was thinking about doing, which is what I think Jerry was mentioning there. And she just asked me about some venues and some people and what I thought about it. And so I just gave her my candid opinion, and she thanked me for it. And, you know, that's the last time I ever talked to her, and really the only time I ever talked to her. But it was nice to have the opportunity to actually have a little one-on-one talk with Ann Gunkel, just to kind of scratch that off of my bucket list, you know, in relation to wrestling. And like I said, from everything that I ever saw, people thought a lot of her and never saw anything negative about her.
All right. Next up on the list is the late, great world champion, legendary world champion dating back into the 40s, Bill Longson. Doubt seriously any of you guys got to see much of his work, if any, other than maybe when you guys were kids, except for Jerry, of course, who carried his bag. Bill wrestled here a lot in the 1940s, not just as champion, but also as a non-champion, just being a traveling star. And yeah, let's put it this way: he's one of those guys from that era that he was going to draw money everywhere he went, and he definitely did so here. A lot of appearances for Paul Jones over the years, so he got in. I don't know if any of you guys have anything to add there. Terms of anything you might know about him?
I met Bill Longson in St. Louis. No matter when we would go there, he was always there. Nicest man, one of the nicest men I ever met. Super nice man. And I'd sit and talk to him, you know, and he was interesting to talk to. Very interesting, and he, you know, I don't think he had any connection with the office there at all with Muchnick or anything, but he was always there every Friday night. He would always be there. I guess St. Louis was his home, but he was there every Friday night. And he was just a super gentleman. I mean, just a pleasure. Always would speak to you, wonder how you're doing, where you've been, and different things like that. But that was the only time I was ever around him, just right there in St. Louis.
His is just one of those names, you know, that's thrown out there with some of the legendary guys. And I think he was NWA champ a couple of times. And He just had a, you know, good reputation. As I understand, he was a good draw as a traveling type competitor, as you mentioned. But I may have seen him in the early 50s on TV, but, you know, once again, I really can't say for sure. I never saw him in Atlanta.
The last time he was in Atlanta was April 11th of 69, when he was used as a special referee in a match with the Assassins and the Spoiler, which, of course, at that time, Spoiler was Bugsy McGraw under a hood, against Doug Gilbert as the Professional and the Kentuckians. So I don't have any record of him appearing here after that. And as a matter of fact, that was the night that McGraw was actually forced to unmask following the match, as the stipulation said they had to the person who was pinned in this match had to unmask, and of course it came to him, and they just ID'd him at the time as Mike Davis, which of course was his real name. Next up on the list for the class of 2010, the Fabulous Freebirds, and here we are talking about the originals, Michael Hayes, Terry Gordy, and Buddy Roberts, just phenomenal tag team in the era of the 80s. Who wants to take the lead on this one?
I'll take it.
All right.
I know when they were here in Georgia, Ted and I worked with them a lot. And it would be Buddy and what's his name?
The Terry. Big boy.
Terry Gordy. And we had some great matches with them. But the hub of that team was Buddy Roberts. I mean, he drove that team. I mean, you know, Gordy could work. Hayes couldn't. That's why I once made him a manager. I'm just being honest. I mean,
I was going to say the same thing. But Michael was good on the stick, but he wasn't good in the ring.
No. Yeah, he could talk, but Buddy was a fantastic worker. He really was. And Gordy came along. You know, he got better and better, and of course, you know, he got into other things. Messed his deal up. He had a good thing in Japan. He messed that up and by his shenanigans. But it's sad. But, the three of them together were good because, like Bobby said, Ace was a good talker. And they had great matches everywhere they went. I mean, they could get down. So that's about all I can say. But they were a good team.
Bobby?
Well, you know, Jerry was talking about Terry. You know, a lot of people don't realize, you know, Terry Gordy, when they first got to Georgia, he wasn't but about 20 years old. He was very young. Terry started working when he was 13 under a hood in Tennessee. I've actually got a video somewhere around here that Gene Bennett gave me of Terry working as Mr. Wrestling in Tennessee when Tez was running opposition to Nick Gulas, and he was 13 years old. And he did come along. He got better as time went along. Buddy Roberts was absolutely phenomenal. He was as smooth as glass. And do anything he wanted to do, anything you needed him to do, Buddy Roberts was there. He was the wrestler of the team. And, of course, Gordy was the brute force. But Michael was very good on that on the microphone. And Michael was the showman. He was the one. When he strutted into the arena, even though he wasn't wrestling, he was going to be the third guy in the corner. He's the one that generated a lot of heat just by his antics and the way he looked with the long hair and the things he would do. Michael was I like Michael. Michael's a nice fellow. He's a good guy, and he's still very active in the business, working for Vince now. But as a team, those three guys come in, and they were just there again. It was something we had never seen in Georgia. Nobody had used the music that much, and they come into the Freebird song, and then they had the Michael would have that long blonde hair and the flowing robes, and they asked for a spotlight when they would come to the ring. I mean, it was very, very theatrical when they got to the ring, and very fortunate that not like a lot of these guys and these teams today that when the bell rings you can't get a match out of them with Terry and Buddy doing the majority of the tag team work. There were some great matches had with those guys.
Jack?
Well, you know, Buddy Roberts was a known factor before the Freebirds ever came in here. He had been part of the Hollywood Blondes that had been a successful team with Jerry Brown. And as mentioned, he was definitely the workhorse. He was the guy that you could look for to carry the match. But Terry Gordy, I tell you, there was, if you talk about raw talent, I think the guy had it. You know, he was certainly not scientific, and he wasn't groomed that way. But he was very talented. Michael Hayes was quite the mouthpiece, you know, and I used to talk to them some up in Marietta during the end of their first time they were here. And those guys, when they were in backstage, they were just like nitroglycerin when you put them together. You didn't know what they were going to do, what they were going to say, what they were going to talk about. I mean, it was really wild in the dressing room. But I think the thing that set them apart more than anything else was, as was mentioned, the music. They weren't the first team to use music, but they were the first team to successfully use that rock and roll music to come in. It set the stage for them, and it set the stage for a lot of people after them, to where now it's just if you have somebody that doesn't have a musical entrance, it seems odd. But, you know, at the time they did it, it was very unusual. And, you know, you just say, here's our music, throw it, and some guy would hopefully have the machine to play it on. Nobody thought anything about copyrights at that time and who owned the music license and all that stuff. It became a big deal later on, and they had to, you know, change their music intro. But it was just something that was so new, and it just set the stage for what was to come later on. And they were, you know, they were a very, very, very successful team, not only here but in Texas and a lot of other places. It's just unfortunate, you know, I mean, teams come and go, but that they just couldn't have stayed together a little longer. But they all kind of went their separate ways, and some had better luck than others. But I felt fortunate to have the opportunity to talk to them a little bit and also to be able to introduce them several times on TV and at the Omni.
You know, I've always been shocked that you guys talk about how good Michael Hayes was on the stick, and God, he was fascinating. But you look at, say, WWE these days, and you got guys like him and Flair that are around, and you've got this, you know, this horrible lack of visibility of a manager. How great would it be for some of these guys who can't really do a promo worth a damn if they were to put those guys out there as managers? That would be great and a little old school. Let me ask you this, though, too. We talk about Buddy Roberts, you know, kind of being the main driver in the team in terms of ring work. What about the teams of Michael Hayes and Big Red and Michael Hayes and Otis Sistrunk? Who carries those teams?
Jerry Oates ought to be shot for training Otis Sistrunk.
Yeah, thanks, Ole.
Let me tell you something.
You could have had a stab at it, Bobby.
I had the pleasure. Well, I was in the ring with Otis. I never worked with him and Michael together. But, you know, Michael, when it come to Michael and Otis, Michael, whatever was carried, Michael had to do it. When it come to Big Red and him, Big Red could do several things, but not a lot. So Michael probably was a guy that worked in those matches. If you notice, those two teams that you mentioned, neither one of them lasted very long.
Right.
I mean,
no,
you know, it just wasn't nothing you could do.
Well, you know, I saw Michael, you know, working single matches when the team broke up and they were leaving. And he had a loser-leave-town match with Tommy Rich in Marietta. And, you know, he could work. By that time, he'd been around a pretty good while. You know, he had to have somebody in there with him that knew what they were doing and could carry him. But you know, he could do a successful match on his own, and he did. But that was just not what he was really good at and what he wanted to do.
Let me say something too. Something to capitalize on something that Jay said there earlier. He talked about those guys in the dressing room. You never knew what they were going to talk about or what they were going to do. They never knew what they were going to talk about or what they were going to do.
Toward the end, they sure didn't.
Listen, you talk about being in a dressing room with them. You should be in a hotel with them. Or you should be on the highway with them and let them pass you or you pass them. It was you never knew. I mean, I've it's the truth. I've seen these guys on the side of the road chasing each other, trying to pee on one another. I mean, they were insane. I mean, they were just, you know, they loved life, and they were, they were just having a good time.
Yes, they were. And, you know, they always reminded me of, you know, backyard wrestling that was talked about. They reminded me of kids that watched wrestling on TV, and that's the way they did it. You know, that was life to them. They just took what they learned from watching TV and made it real, and they had a good time.
Yes, they did.
All right. Next up on the docket, Jerry trained this guy. He was big in the 1930s. I love you, Jerry.
A product of Oates Gym.
He got his start in 1929 here in Atlanta and actually wrestled quite frequently through 1949 at the latest that we've got recorded. Jack McAdams, he used to wrestle a lot for the promoter that we talked about here before, Frank Bettis, who was running the competition heavily in, throughout the 30s against the main Atlanta office, which at the time was, of course, run by Henry Weber and L.C. Warren and Frank Spear. And there was actually a time in 1938 where he was working for not only Frank Bettis's group, but he was also working for L.C. Warren. So that he's one of the few that seem to be doing that, working for, I guess, opposing promoters. And he was also billed as the Southern Light Heavyweight Champion. That was a big title that was used heavily in Bettis's group over the years, and he won that thing several times. I didn't have it here in my notes, but big name that was heavily used throughout the 30s and 40s, Jack McAdams. Jerry, what was it like to train him? Was he a good kid?
He was stiff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
By the time you knew him, right?
He was cold, too.
next up on the list, he's already in, and we've covered him well as part of the tag team of the Assassin. But in this time for his work as a singles competitor, he did quite a bit here, and then not just in Georgia Championship Wrestling, but beyond that. And also for his work as a promoter for Deep South Wrestling, Joe Hamilton. Bobby?
I don't know what else we can say about Jody. He was been a friend of mine for a lot of years, and he took me under his wing a little bit when I first started and kind of helped me, told me what not to do, what to do, and I tried to listen to him and learn all I could. He let me ride with him a lot, and I learned a lot from him. He's just a dear friend to me. And as far as, you know, when he started promoting, when we were working for Ann, him and Rock Hunter teamed up as a promotion team, and they ran some towns together. And they were very successful in the towns they ran. They ran some towns over in South Carolina. I remember one time we ran right in Charlotte's back door. We ran Shelby, North Carolina, which is a rock's throw from Charlotte. And if I remember, we drew a pretty good house up there. But Jody was for a man his size, he could do anything he wanted to do. I'll never forget, as long as my mind will function, to see a guy that size that could flat foot throw a drop kick and hit you in the jaw. Could throw a flying head scissors as good as a guy half his size. And he was just a phenomenal performer and a good wrestler. And I'm thrilled that I came along at the time that I was able to work with them and see them work together.
Jay?
Well, you know, in addition to the persona of the Assassin and the Bolos, which he was originally in the Carolinas, which was the predecessor of the Assassins, but, you know, late in his career, he also worked in Alabama as the Flame. And I never quite understood that persona totally. You know, I never saw the fireball gimmick as something, you know, that was positive. for believability. But besides that, he was strictly the same guy, just a little different color outfit. But that was something that he also did. But I really enjoyed the Deep South TV show that he did with Rock Hunter. And in the 80s there, that was probably the last wrestling show that I really paid any attention to on television. And it was real old school, by that time. But I liked it. As far as talking to him after he had quit his initial run as a competitor, he worked behind the scenes, and I'd talked to him some down at Griffin when Doug Smith was promoting down there, and he'd be down there with the guys. And, he was another one of those guys, if you could kind of get him away, he was fun to talk to. I didn't know him hardly at all, but, he was okay to talk to, and I enjoyed the little time that I did have with him. But the TV show, I think the Deep South show, really, it's just kind of lost, and it really was very entertaining, and that part of his career I enjoyed a lot.
Jerry?
Well, besides being one half of the greatest tag teams that I ever saw or was ever in the ring with, he was just as good as a single, in my opinion. Whether it was a single or a tag or, it didn't matter to Jody, he could do whatever needed to be done and do it well. And when he was running Mid-South, I got to be there with him and wrestle for him. I enjoyed that, and we had a good time with it, and we had some great houses, and I just wish it had lasted longer than it did. But I can't say anything but great things about Jody Hamilton. I'm like Bobby. I'm glad I got to know him.
And, talking about the single matches, we have discussed it before, but some of the program he ran, with Dick Steinborn, those were some outstanding matches that he had with Dick.
Next up on the list of the class of 2010, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. Nick Patrick. Bobby?
I first met Nick when he was about 12, maybe 13. He used to, in the summer when he was out of school, he'd make trips with us. And he always wanted to drive. I don't know if he ever got over his love of driving or not, but he always wanted to drive when he was 12 or 13. Nick came into Atlanta when Jody was actually, he came in, I believe, as the assistant booker. We needed a referee, and Nick had worked some up around the St. Joe area and the Kansas City area, and they gave him a shot here, and of course he just he worked out well, became a great referee. And then of course he wanted to, in the back of his mind, he wanted to wrestle, he wanted to do that. So when we in 85, when we were running working with Ann there, Jerry and Ted were booking, and they did a little angle where the first TV we did, I think, or the second TV we did, they did a little deal where they turned him, he threw the referee shirt down and became a wrestler, and had some pretty good matches with Randy Rose and Doug Summers and Ron Starr and the guys that we had there. Unfortunately, his wrestling career was cut short. He went out to work for Bill Watts, and he blew his knee out, and that kind of ended his wrestling career, but came back to referee some more, and had a good career and a good run for Vince. I think as far as I know, last time I talked to him, he's doing some personal training, and he's probably in better shape now than he ever was when he was in the ring, or he was last time I saw him. And he's I think he lives down near his dad in Griffin, and he's kind of doing the training thing, and seems to be doing well. But yeah, he's well deserving to be there. He came along as another generation of referee, and he did an outstanding job. So I'm proud he's in there.
Jerry?
Nick was as good as anybody that refereed, I think. Of course, Bobby was among one of the best. And Nick, he was right there with him. Nick worked real hard, just as Bobby did in the ring. He was always at the right place at the right time. of course, he was raised in the business, so, you know, a lot of that was natural to him. But I always thought he did a great job, and I was glad to see he got a break up in New York. I don't know how long his run was there, but I'm sure he made some money up there, and he deserved it. And I can't say anything but good things about Nick Patrick.
Jack.
Well, he, you know, his relationship to Jody, I think, was one of those best-kept secrets. I never heard anybody, any of the fans, talk about knowing what his relationship was. But he came along as a referee towards the latter part of the time that I was working as a ring announcer there on TV and at the Omni. And, you know, he was very conscientious. He kept control in the ring. He looked very professional. And he did a good job. And I remember the show Bobby was talking about where he wanted to become a wrestler, you know, there in the mid-'80s, and he threw down the shirt, and he got a chance to do that. But he really had a long career working for Vince in the WWF, then the WWE, and, you know, more power to him. I was glad to see him have the success that he had. And I'm glad to hear that he's still doing well.
And last but not least, rounding out the class of 2010, another guy that was very much associated with Joe Hamilton, Rock Connor. I always loved this guy as a manager. Bobby?
I probably learned more about crowd psychology from Rock Hunter than I did anybody else in the business. The guy with just a look could make people come up out of their seats. With another look, he could put them right back in their seats. He was the consummate guy to, as far as controlling a crowd, or I thought he was. I got to work with Rock in the ring many times as far as refereeing his matches and things. He was very quiet. He was very protective of the business. He didn't say a whole lot. Very, very businesslike. Just went about his business as well as anybody. I honestly think he's underrated as a manager because I thought he's one of the best managers that's ever come down the pike. Rock was from old school. Less is more. He didn't run around and beat on the ring and scream and yell and blow whistles and tote a cane or any of that stuff. He'd just come out with his guys. He'd sit in the corner. If something called for him making a move, he made the little move, did what he had to do, and he'd go sit back down. He did not take away from his guy in the ring. He did not take away from the match, and he only did what was necessary for his part in the match to get the match over. And he could talk good on TV. And he, you know, and they, I just, I think he's underrated in that aspect. But I'm very happy Rock made the Hall of Fame. I think he's well deserving of it. He had a long career, and he was a nice guy. He was a good guy. I hate he's withdrawn himself from the business. He won't go to any of the reunions. He has very little to do with anything in the business anymore. But I wish he'd come back around some. I'd love to see him. But that's he was a. Last time I saw him, I guess, was when they were doing the Deep South thing. I had the privilege of refereeing a couple of times for Jody, and I saw him then. I guess that was the last time I saw Rock.
Jerry?
Well, as Bobby said, he was always business. I mean, it was Rock was, to me, he was always kind of a quiet man. It was about the business, and I think if more guys had been more like Rock as far as the business would have been a better place, but he was that's what he was. He was about business, and he was as good as anybody at what he did. And I always got along great with Rock. I know when I first opened my gym, he made me several pieces of equipment, and I had them till the day I closed it. And I'd go up to LaGrange. I think he was living in a LaGrange gym, wasn't he, Bobby?
He was somewhere closer to Carrollton, I think. He was somewhere up that way.
It was Carrollton. And I'd go up, and he'd call me, tell me he's ready. I'd go up there and get him. We talk about the business a little bit, but, you know, we just reminisced on what we did together. But I enjoyed Rock, and, of course, I hadn't seen him in many, many, many years. But He was a businessman. Have nothing but kind words to say about Rock Hunter. Can't say anything bad about him.
Jack?
Well, you know, I think it's pretty well been stated here. He was, in my opinion, and the other guys have said it, he was very underrated as both the manager and a wrestler. I thought, you know, I saw him wrestle many times, and he was very good in the ring. He had, but his interviews were interesting. You could watch him. He was very subtle in his speech pattern, and you know, he was just a fun guy to watch. And he, as I said, he was protective of the business. He did actually in the mid '80s. I was living back at home with my parents after I changed jobs, and my first wife had passed away, and I was. It was something to do with one of the Jim Wilson Thunderbolt lawsuits or something, and Rock had pulled away from Jody for a time there, and I forget why we were thrown together, but he came over to my parents' house one night, and we talked about some of the situations that were taking place, and he was a very soft-spoken guy, and it was very interesting to see him away from the element. And I enjoyed that conversation, and never talked to him again. But I just think that if people just, you know, you're going to say, give me top five names or something like that of managers, and Rock's not going to be there. But when you look at his work, it deserves to be there.
Absolutely.
Where is he living now? Does anybody know where he's living?
He's still around Carrollton, last I heard. I think he's the same place. Funny story about Rock. I mean, it's just a little side story here. When him and Jody were business partners on the promotions and things. Back when CBs got big and everybody was getting CB radios, Rock was driving a conversion van that he had, and he got a CB, and he was trying to come up with a name, a handle for his CB. So Jody gave him the name Prospector. And he told me, we were somewhere one night, and he said, well, I said, well, what's your handle? He said, Prospector. And I said, well, where'd you come up with Prospector? And Jody started laughing. He said, what does a prospector do? Or what is a prospector? And I said, well, he pans for gold, looks for some, you know. He said, he's a rock hunter. So I said, okay.
That's good. I like that.
I thought that was good.
I talked to him about that, too. Do you know where that that name came from, Rock Hunter?
No.
It was there was a movie called Will Success Spoil Rock Hunter? And Jane Mansfield was in it. And, you know, he had wrestled as worked as a German on the West Coast. And at some point, he took that name, and he said, yeah, that's where I took it from.
Huh.
That's good stuff. Well, guys, any more thoughts on the class of 2010 before we start to wrap things up here?
No, this was a pretty good class.
Yeah,
yes,
it was.
Sir.
All right. And in future shows, we got two more in this series. We're going to do 2011 the next time we get together. And we'll wrap it up with 2012 and 2013. And actually, ballots for the 2014 class go out in June. So, and they'll be announced in November on our anniversary. And we'll move on to other themes. We've got some ideas that have been sent to us. If anybody else listening wants to get any ideas for themes for for future shows to start sometime in May, possibly June, depending on our schedule. We never know for sure. Look me up on Facebook, send them there, or you can email them to me at rich@georgiawrestlinghistory.com. Guys, I know I cannot do next week. Baseball take precedence, so at the earliest 2 weeks out.
Okay.
Sounds good to me.
All right. Well, we want to thank everybody for tuning in tonight and listening and your continued support. And we ask everybody to please spread the word and let everybody know about Peach State Pandemonium and, of course, anything else going on at GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Also, I want to remind everybody the old Facebook group is going to go away. We started up the Facebook page just last week, so jump on over there and like that before we end up closing down the group, probably around the end of this month. Get over there and like that and keep up with all the updates. All right, we'll talk to you guys next time.
Okay.
All
right. Good night,
guys.
We thank you for listening to this broadcast, a production brought to you by the GWH Radio Network. Stay tuned to GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com for the latest information on upcoming events and more. As always, we thank you for your continued support.
If you're hurt, get the money you deserve. If you're in pain, get the money you deserve. At Terry and Peterman, we're personal injury attorneys who take a professional, thorough approach to your accident and injury claims. Don't call some long-distance law firm or satellite office. Don't trust your claim to just anyone. For a free consultation, call the law office of Terry and Peterman today, 229-247-0386, or go online at www.terryandpeterman.com. The law offices of Terry and Peterman, making things right.